Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon with our friend Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for over 30 years. He knows what he's talking about. If you have a question about your vehicle, it's always fun to try to diagnose it. From here in Studio A, the number to call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also check in online. You can visit the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can tweet us if you wish. That's at WAMC Vox Pop. You could go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org. You know, it's been a while since I've done the show.
Yes.
I've kind of forgotten what it's all about. Glad you're here.
Yeah, is your car running okay?
My car, in general, it's running okay, although I do want to do a pressure test. Losing coolant.
Well, that's got you nervous at times, doesn't it?
A little bit of coolant. Well, because the North Star engine in my Cadillac, it's a 99 DeVille, is infamous for blowing head gaskets and... So I'm quite concerned, but you talked me off the ledge before, and I'm counting on you to do it again.
I still think you might be okay, because we talked earlier, and you're not getting any nasty symptoms like heavy steam out of the exhaust system or skipping after you start the car up after it's sat several hours or overnight.
No, it starts right up, it runs well, and no steam yet, and I've seen that. I've had that happen before.
Yeah.
So we have our fingers crossed, but we will do a pressure test. So when they pressure test an engine, what exactly happens?
Yeah, in your case, they're going to pressure test the cooling system.
Right.
So a device gets threaded onto the what you'd consider the radiator cap or the pressure tank like on your car. And it's like a bicycle pump. You actually put some air pressure on top of the cooling system and anywhere from 15 to 20 pounds. And that's what the car is running at normally under pressure during warmer weather or normal operating conditions. And we simulate this with a pump. And then you see if the pressure decreases. And if it does, look around for a leak. And if you find a leak on the outside of the engine and cooling system, it can indicate a hose, a clamp, a connection.
Which would be best case scenario.
Yes. If you see the pressure drop, but you don't see any liquid anywhere else, and you're fearful that it's going into a bad place, that's what you don't want to hear.
Right. That's when the price goes up exponentially.
Very much so.
So when you do a pressure test of a cooling system, is it like testing an old bicycle tire where you'd put some soapy water over the...
You could. Yeah. I mean, what we generally look for, because we're going to have the system full of coolant when we test it, so we're looking for the actual antifreeze to leak out somewhere.
And you can see that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's go to the phones. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. So far, have not given the fund drive number, so we're off to a flying start. Bruce in Gilderland. Bruce, you're first.
Yes. If your guest were to buy a brand-new sedan, from the point of view of mechanical reliability and durability, what brand or brands would he consider?
Boy, you know, I get asked that question a lot of times. You know, what would you buy? And some of it has to do with personal preference, what you feel like driving, what looks good to you. But I know what your question is implying, that you want to stay away from cars that are going to be lots of trouble. Is that pretty much? Yeah. Do you have any brand preference? And what's on your mind? And I'll tell you if that's a good choice or not.
Well, boy, you turn the tables on.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. You see, Bruce?
I'm asking the questions now.
He's a professional.
Yeah. I'm a Buick owner. I've always liked Buicks, but I get the impression that the better Japanese cars have really sailed ahead in quality.
Is that a myth?
Compared to even good American cars like a Buick.
Yeah. That is true. The Japanese, at first, when they first came to the country, were viewed as just little tin rusty cracker boxes, and everybody kind of laughed at them, like they did the Beetle when it came in the 50s. But they've proven themselves to be very reliable, long-lasting, fairly low maintenance cars. So yes, and you've got the big brands. You got Honda, Toyota, and Nissan, and Subaru are the strong Japanese cars, and that encompasses most of them. Mitsubishi, in my opinion, I hope the Mitsubishi people aren't going to call up and get mad, but is not on par with the rest of them.
Didn't they stop making cars?
Mitsubishi? No, they're still making them, and they're still available. And it's a major, it's a big, big company in Asia.
Yeah.
The Korean cars, I'm not particularly fond of.
Now, that's one brand?
Kia and Hyundai.
Okay.
And they've come a long way. They're definitely better cars than they were when they first started. What I see, of course, I'm seeing a lot of these cars when they're 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 years old, and that's mm-hmm. that's the proof is in the pudding. Then,
why I'm calling you.
How rusty they get, what holds up. So, the big Japanese are good. European cars can be a little finicky, but they've got a real good handle on rust and corrosion protection, safety, solid feeling, good sturdy cars, but not to downplay the U.S. makes, because they have gotten very good too, and they're pretty much getting up on par with everybody else. So it's not an easy choice. I can't say just get a Honda Civic or get a Toyota Corolla or get a Subaru Outback. They're all good choices.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you know it's still up to you, Bruce.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. So the last Buick I looked at and pined after was early 90s, and it was the return of the Roadmaster.
Oh,
and that was a car.
We went on a vacation years ago, and my good friend of mine borrowed his in-law's Roadmaster station wagon, and it was about a 96 vintage car. What a big boat, but so nice and comfortable and great ride.
You know, you made a comment about, and we'll get right back to the phones in a moment, 800-348-2551. You made a comment about corrosion and rust protection and how American cars are improving in that regard. Shouldn't that be the easiest thing to guard against?
It is not as difficult as it sounds, but it's expensive. It costs the car manufacturers more money to go with non-ferrous metals, rust-free metals in certain areas, stainless steel, aluminum, things like that that don't completely rust or corrode to pieces, brake lines and things like that. It adds to the cost of the vehicle. All the special paints, the dipping of the car and the wax, the hot wax flooding makes the car a lot more expensive. And that's why a lot of your European cars traditionally cost more, but they've got all that stuff already in them.
All right, so I'll get a Porsche next time. It'll be rust-free, and that'll be perfect. Abby in Woodstock. Abby.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a 1987 Ford Falcon camper van, and I have two problems that I haven't been able to solve. One is fixing the relay that will make my gas gauge work for the two gas tanks. They say it's a huge job to drop the tanks and put in that little part. And also my windshield wiper relay, intermittent relay, I have to pull over and turn the van off to turn the windshield wipers off because there's something going on with that. If you have any answers for those problems.
So your van has dual gas tanks. Is that what you're
saying?
Yes. Okay. And you are not able to switch from one to the other anymore?
No, I can switch. I just, it won't give me the amount of gas, the gas gauge, the part that tells me how much gas is in the tanks doesn't work.
So does the gauge read on either of your tanks?
No, it just stays on empty, you know, even though they're filled.
So you know you can go from one tank to the other, but the gas gauge never changes.
Right.
Okay. The problem, it could be in that switching unit that what those vehicles did was the, let's say you're running on the front tank and you decide it's time to go to the rear tank. When you throw the switch, it shuts off the fuel pump and the signal from the front tank and immediately turns on the rear tank. And that's what you're reading up on your, in your instruments. And that information may be getting lost when it switches from one to the other. The other possibility is the gauge is no good, and the gauge is the same gauge for both tanks. So to answer the question, it does require a bunch of diagnosis to see what the problem is.
I see.
So there's not an easy answer to that, because if the gauge doesn't work for either, it could be the gauge itself.
So you wouldn't have to drop the tank for that.
Maybe not.
Well, that would be good.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, because that would be good.
Because an 87 could be, you know, as we spoke about earlier, that could be getting rusty.
Right. And it's been kept very well. They say it's like brand new underneath. So, you know, it could possibly be the actual where you switch from front to back. Maybe that component is not working correctly as far as sending the amounts.
It's entirely possible.
All right. Hey, Abby, we got to take a break here, but thank you very much for the call. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be back.
Support comes from Nature Logs, featuring nature photography by Scott Stoner and Denise Hackard Stoner, photo sales, note cards, slide presentations, and workshops. Bringing you the beauty of nature, naturelogs.com. Snow Farm, studio craft workshops for adults and teens, glass blowing, woodworking, ceramics, jewelry, and much more. Simple dorms, homemade meals, and four seasons. In Williamsburg, Massachusetts, snowfarm.org. And Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, contact lenses, and eye exams since 1953. Sheehy Opticians.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. So nice to be back in regular programming mode, and it's my first chance to thank everybody who made a pledge during the fund drive, which ended on Monday, and what a good time we had, but so nice to be back to regular programming, and the lines are loaded here, so let's go to Annie and Troy. Annie.
Hello. I have a very old car. It's a 1996 Windstar. I bought it at 55,000 miles. I drive it about 5,000 to 7,000 miles a year. And it's now 102,000 miles. I was hoping to keep it for another 7 years. Because I just don't need a car very much, but winter comes and you really want to have a car. I want to know at what point our car is just too old.
Yeah, it's a good question. In the Northeast and in our part of the country where salt is used to keep the roads clear, that's what kills most vehicles around here prematurely or ahead of their time. And when the Ford Windstars had their share of rust and corrosion issues.
Guy says that the corrosion is surface and is not the problem.
Well, that could be. And not knowing or seeing your vehicle, sometimes a vehicle looks fairly good on the outside, and when you raise it up on a lift, there's some serious rust in things like the subframes, in the unibody, things that hold the suspension in the vehicle. That's what I'd be concerned with on an aging vehicle to see if it's deemed still to be safe and if you're not going to be having a lot of trouble related to rust, brake lines, fuel lines, suspension anchoring points, things like that. That's of concern when a vehicle gets old up around here.
The other part that I wondered about was, you know, it's a 96, so it has airbags, but it doesn't have side airbags. My passengers don't have headrests. So I thought, maybe I should give everybody a little more safety.
There's no headrests?
There's headrests for me, but not for the second seat.
I didn't realize that was a new thing.
Well, that could be in the back rows. But yeah, I mean, newer stuff I think's got a headrest for every occupant.
Yeah.
I had the engine rebuilt 2 years ago. It has new tires, but I just took a huge trip to Toronto and back, And then I took it into the repair shop just to have it double checked. And he said I didn't have any back brakes. I didn't notice any lack of back brakes.
Oh, boy.
But it made me think, well, maybe I should stop repairing things.
Yeah, I'd get an opinion on the condition of the underside due to rust. See what they say about that.
Okay, Annie, thanks a lot. Let's go over to Joe in Petersburg. Joe, you're up.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2003 Chevy Silverado. And the torque converter, it has a locked-up torque converter, and it works fine at slower speeds. But when I get on the highway around 60 to 65, it unlocks, and it stays unlocked until I slow down. Do you have any idea what that might be?
Are you you're certain that that's what's occurring? I mean, you can feel it go out of that lockup mode. It almost feels like it dropped down a half a gear.
Yes, it unlocks, and the RPMs come up. Probably a couple hundred RPM. It's not a huge difference, but it is definitely unlocking, and it will not lock back up until I get going like below 50 again.
Does your truck have the tow haul mode button?
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Experiment with that tow haul and just see if it acts differently in tow haul, then take it out and drive it the same way. I mean, it is possible that the computer is commanding the converter off, but maybe not for the right reason. And a way to tell, which you can't do, but a shop and primarily a transmission repair shop, they'll bring a scan tool in the vehicle and plug it into the data link connector, and they will watch what the transmission is up to. If the computer commands the transmission torque converter to lock up, you'll see the data, you'll see the RPMs change, and you'll also feel it.
But that's not something that will trigger a code.
It can. A lot of transmission issues will turn on the check engine light and register a code, but not all.
Hmm. So can it fire a code without firing the check engine
yes.
light?
Yes. Oh, yeah. You can have codes in your computer that are not considered emission related, and they won't turn the check engine light on.
So it's possible that it's just a computer needs perhaps a reset. In other words, it's leaving it all the time in tow mode.
I don't know. I wanted to see if he drove it made any difference whether it was in tow or regular mode, because that changes the parameters of how the transmission operates.
All right, let's go to Olive in Huntington. Olive, you're on. Try the button again. Hello, Olive.
Go
ahead.
I'm sorry. I have no idea what happened with the guy before. It was a really weird sound. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Okay. I will tell you, I'm calling because I think there's something that your audience needs to know. I'm on my third Subaru. My 2001 Subaru in 2007 when I was getting near the time where I was getting my next Subaru, about 2 years before that, the engine light was going on all the time. And I spent maybe thousands of dollars on various things that were getting replaced that didn't need to be replaced, didn't change the engine light. And it was like a guessing game. Then I found myself at a gas station pumping gas into the car. And I found my feet getting wet. And it meant that the gas was pouring into the filler neck, and the filler neck had corroded to such a degree that it was corroded all the way down, almost to the gas tank itself. And gas was pouring all out onto the ground. And I just obviously stopped. I went in and told them at the gas station that they have a serious problem to help clean this up. It's very dangerous. I got in my car, I turned the ignition on, and went about three blocks to a mechanic I knew and brought the car there. I found out afterwards that in doing this, that I was very lucky that there wasn't a spark and I didn't start an explosion.
Oh.
No, nobody had mentioned anything about the filler necks or anything else with the previous, you know, let's say 16 months of going in and out and everything else, putting gas caps on. The Subaru dealership in my area never even took a look at the filler neck.
All right, let's not mention any names here, Olive.
No, I didn't mention any names.
Okay, good.
But the reason I'm saying that is I was so angry and upset about this because it was something that could have easily been picked up and you could be warned as a Subaru owner. And we were not told, and I wrote to the Subaru CEO, actually heard back from him in Seattle, or wherever he is, New Jersey, I think it is. And I had someone call me from his office and basically do a public relations soundbite about going to the Subaru dealership, that there's a problem, blah, 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 blah. So I just basically didn't pay much attention.
All right.
I'm now on my next Subaru, and the same thing has happened again. But this time I'm much more wise. I brought it into my mechanic. I said, first thing to check the filler neck. And he did, and I have to replace it.
Yikes.
So I'm just saying that this is something that wouldn't be a bad thing for Subaru owners to be aware of.
Well, thanks, Olive. What do you think? Is this a common occurrence?
Yes, we've replaced a lot of Subaru filler pipes. It's not uncommon at all. There's a little bend, a little dip in that pipe right around there, and I think that's where things collect, and it's also a salt-prone area from wheel and road spray. And
okay.
Yes, they do rust through.
All right, so I'm curious. Olive had a check engine light.
Yep.
Is that something that will trigger a check engine light?
Yes.
Okay, so why not check the code and find out what it is?
Here's the thing. When you get a code for that would be a large EVAP leak. It may start out as a small EVAP leak. And the way to find that is to do what's called a smoke test.
Mm-hmm.
And you introduce smoke into the gas tank venting system. And that checks everything from the cap to the engine.
Yeah.
And if you do that to this car, you will find a lot of smoke pouring out of that filler neck. And that would lead you to the problem.
Now, I'm not sure what the rules are in Massachusetts as far as passing inspection, but if you have an EVAP issue in New York, you're not going to pass inspection.
Exactly.
And so I would think that a filler neck would be cheaper than some of the other EVAP codes that come down where it's sensors or something else,
yep.
And it can be a real struggle.
Yeah, it's not a giveaway job, but it's not the worst.
Yeah.
And it's due to corrosion.
All right, let's go to Graham in Preston, Maryland, is that?
Yes, oh, Graham here.
You're on,
how
Graham.
Are you? Yes, sir. I have an 05. I just bought it a couple weeks ago, an 05 Chevrolet Silverado 2500 HD, the Duramax. It's my second one. Love the truck. And my question for your guest is the steering column. There seems to be this, whenever I hit little bumps in the road or overpass, it's like a rattle, and almost like a loose rattle. And my old Silverado, the old 3 I had, the same thing. When I've talked to friends, they say that's a GM thing. The old Silverado trucks have that. Wondering if he's ever heard of that and if there is a fix for that.
Hmm.
Yep. Yeah, that's very common, and it's very common in a lot of General Motors vehicles, not only the pickups, but a lot of the cars. And the noise that you're hearing is coming from what's called the intermediate steering shaft. And it's a sliding shaft that's a safety feature. So if you're in a severe frontal collision and things start to get pushed backwards, those collapsible columns were designed so that it wouldn't push the steering wheel into your chest.
Yeah.
And particular one on these vehicles has a little bit too loose of a fit, and that's what gives you that noise. The original fix from GM was to slide it apart and put a very thick special grease that they provided in there. And that would kind of take up the space.
Yeah.
And that worked great for about 6 months to a year, and then the noise would come back.
You need more grease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It would pound the grease out. And
where did the grease go?
It's still there, but it's getting displaced and moved around, and it's not filling up the gap anymore. So in the meantime, they did redesign that intermediate shaft. So there is a tighter, improved part available for that vehicle.
Okay. For an 05?
Yeah.
05?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not dangerous. It's more of an annoyance.
And I like, my vehicles, I like everything to be tight and it's driving me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. You could try the special grease. I don't know if you can still buy it, but it was almost
Can you just use butter?
It was almost like a paste.
Mm.
Okay.
But that's what's happening to your truck, and it's happening to millions of them. It's not uncommon at all.
Okay.
Okay. Can I one last quick question?
Sure thing. You're calling from Maryland. I think it's okay.
Yeah. Okay. The Allison transmission I have, the filter on that, how often should that be changed?
I think there's intervals depending on how hard you use the truck, if you're towing or, you know, really using it heavily. And to be honest with you, I just don't know what those intervals are. But that transmission is so robust and so good that you probably will never have a problem with it. But I would do all the maintenance that it requires when it requires it, and I think you'll be great.
Wow.
Okay.
That's
great.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks, guys. All right. Bye-bye.
Of course, that's a kiss of death, Gordon. You'll never have a problem with it.
Boy, I don't say that very often, do I?
Well, that's high praise indeed. Let's go to Eric and Saugerties. Eric.
Hey, Gordon. Ray.
Hey.
Hey.
What's up?
Well, I don't know. What's up?
Well, I got a 2004 Chevy Blazer, 4.3 liter, has absolutely no power. Runs great.
So when you say no power, it won't even move, or it's just way weaker?
It will move. It will move in low range. If I put it in, you know, drop it down into one, it'll move. But that's pretty much it.
And did this come about suddenly, or has this been getting worse and worse and worse as you've driven it, and finally it's reached this point?
Gradual, yep.
Gradual, yeah. Any check engine light on?
Yeah.
Have you extracted any codes? Do you know what the light's on?
Yeah. I had one for emissions. There were actually like four or five different codes.
Oh boy.
The biggest one was emissions.
You don't remember? You remember what the other ones were?
No, it's just been going on for a year now.
Yeah. My first real quick thought could be a plugged catalytic converter.
That's what I thought, and I was told to cut that out, but I didn't want to do that.
I wouldn't just cut it out. There's other ways to confirm that.
It's not legal to do that, is it?
No. But there's an easy way to confirm whether it's a plug converter if you're suspicious of it. There's tests you can do. There's equipment you can put in there. But basically, if it's not too rusty, if you can loosen up the Y-pipe, you know, the most frontmost exhaust pipe that goes to the manifolds, loosen that up on both sides and separate it. You don't have to take it out, but just make a big gap there between the Y-pipe and the manifold so a lot of exhaust can get by there.
Okay.
And then go drive it. And if all of a sudden you've got all the power back, you got a plugged exhaust system. And if you don't, you didn't spend any money on, you didn't waste your money on replacing things that were unnecessary. It's a very backyard, quick and easy test.
Now, just let me mention, when I was working the throttle body manually on the engine, I was working that, and I touched the manifold, and I got a bad shock. And I have a brand new battery in this, and it went dead. Just sit. So I have an electrical problem, too.
So none of the codes, you don't remember if any of the codes were electrical related?
They weren't. No. It was all emissions. And I replaced the, I'm looking at it right now. It comes off the air filter right in. The EMF.
Yep,
right?
The airflow sensor.
Yep, airflow sensor. I replaced that. That had no help.
Yep. Here's another. Okay. Another quick thing you can do if you're suspicious of a plug catalytic converter is to, let's say you're in drive and you're trying to get power out of this thing and it's not going anywhere. It's just making a bunch of noise but not moving. Click it up into neutral, and if the engine doesn't really change much in and out of gear, don't put it back into gear. I don't want you to ruin the transmission.
Yeah.
If it still makes all that howling and bogging and nothing's happening, that's also a good indication that the exhaust system's plugged, because the engine can't get the air out. The engine's just a massive air pump.
So if it's a catalytic converter that is plugged, does that mean you can unplug it, or do you need to buy a new one?
You've got to replace it.
And that's expensive, right?
Yeah. But it's
and I thought it was a transmission problem. So what I did was I dropped the pan, I changed the fluid, and put a new filter in, thinking that, you know, it was a transmission problem. So after I did that, that wasn't the case. And then I also thought I wasn't getting fuel enough, so I replaced the filter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I would do that test by unbolting those the Y pipes and see what happens.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. So this is not a throttle sensor issue then. This is the engine is throttling, but it just has no power.
My impression of what he's explaining is, yeah, he's got the thing just about to the floor, and it's just not going anywhere, and it's making noises. And yeah, we do run into that, and it could be a plugged exhaust, plugged catalytic converter.
And Eric's first thought was it was a tranny issue, and it's not?
I don't think so, no. No, I think the engine's not developing any power, and that's where I would start.
Gordon Fricke is our guest. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and the lines are loaded. We will hit the home stretch, and by golly, we'll get as many calls in as we can. Coming up.
Support comes from H. Houston Sun True Value Hardware and Just Ask Rentals, Woodstock, New York. Providing energy-safe ideas for home winterizing since 1932, behind every project is a true value. HHouse.com. United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, working to create opportunities in education, financial stability, and health in the community. Live United, give, advocate, volunteer. UnitedWayGCR.org. And Lexington Vacuum, Albany, New York, a local independent vacuum dealer of Miele, Sebo, Simplicity, Dyson, Electrolux, and more. Sales, service, repairs. LEXIVAC.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and our guest is Gordon Fricke today. All right, Gordon, here's one that came in via email. I have a 2004 Ford Freestar van. I have 185,000 miles on it. Ford has a recall on the torque converter transmission. They say that the transmission can stop working at any time, causing a loss of power, possibly creating a hazardous condition. My question is that I have never had any problems with the transmission. Should I have this recall performed with so many miles on the car? Will taking the old transmission apart create any other possible problems that may cause me unexpected expenses or possible problems in the future? Or should I let it be and let it age gracefully? Although the car runs well, I have recently had the check engine light come on too. I don't know if the two are related since I haven't had the code checked out yet. That's from Tom and Rhinebeck.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Here's the thing with recalls. They are good for the life of the vehicle no matter who owns it.
Okay.
Because it's a safety situation the federal government is calling in or having the manufacturers take care of. And because it's a potential safety issue, they recommend everybody get cars in for recalls. Get them all done, and then that's just less potential problems out on the highway. I don't know to what extent they're going to go into that transmission, but yes, at 185,000 miles.
You fix one thing and eight more things will pop up?
I would want to know more in detail what they're going to do in there, if they're going to switch it with another transmission, put in a new torque converter. It's his option not to bring it in.
Yeah.
So you could just play it by ear. Don't throw the recall letter away. Not that that's your ticket to home.
Right.
But if a year from now something goes wrong, he's still got the recall in his back pocket.
As long as you don't die in an accident.
Well, that's the other thing. So, you know, it's a touchy area.
All right. Well, thank you for your email. Let's go back to the phones. David in Cambridge. David, you're on.
Oh, hi, everybody. You know, since you brought up lockup torque converters and transmissions, I used to occasionally work on other people's cars while working for this fellow years ago. And every so often, if you get someone like the nice lady with the 93 Buick Century, and suddenly her car suddenly just goes boom at the stoplight, it's kind of like you let out the clutch too soon, and the lockup torque converter locks up, and it really shouldn't, because you're sitting at a stoplight. that can be rectified by unscrewing the solenoid that locks up the lock-up torque converter. Then it goes back to being, the old-fashioned mush-o-matic, if you will. But the car will be okay. You know, some of the 93 Buick, you probably don't want to put new transmission in it. And chances are she probably doesn't drive in the highway anymore anyway. But that's a quick fix. Just I figure I'd put that out there. Disclaimer, when it comes to being an automotive engineer, I'm one heck of a punk band drummer, but I just figure I'd let you know.
All right, fair enough.
The other thing that I've been talking to, part of what I'm doing here is I'm designing a vehicle. It's an alternative energy vehicle, if you will. Yeah. But it's the same corporate model as Tesla, but I'm going low tech.
Okay.
And I mean low tech. I'm using solid axles. It's basically a 1930 car.
Okay.
I've been talking to very good, reputable people about what to use for a solid front axle, rather to use ductile iron, there's one company that puts out a really beautiful forged aluminum I-beam axle that's made out of
depleted uranium.
It's just your plain old run the mill. Boy, I had the numbers written down. It's the 50,000 or whatever. Isn't that a kick in the head? I can't find it here. Anyways, it's made out of aircraft grade aluminum. The first digit's 5. There's 4 of them, and that's forged. And
okay.
Then you've got the boat anchor, which is a 4-inch drop, and it's a forged steel I-beam axle, which, in my opinion, if you're going to build a car that goes a million miles, let's say like a Mercedes 240D, only faster, with this, which would be, of course, I just loaded the question.
Yeah, well, is there a question?
Dave, I'm going to cut to the chase.
Use
the aluminum one. It's way lighter, and you're looking for a fuel-efficient
car. Well, that's a good point.
Well, it's unsprung weight, but here's
still
the kicker.
Weight.
Yeah, the kicker is this thing has been tested, and it can bend 10 million times. But the problem is with our decaying infill structure, do you know how many times this thing is going to flex, let's say 100 miles?
Okay.
And then what? Opposed to the boat anchor, which is low-tech, you know, think of Henry Royce. It might be an anachronism, but he knows his works, you know? I'm loading the question again, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, I would still go with the aluminum. I'm sticking to the aluminum.
Lightweight. You want energy efficiency.
You want to push 500 pounds of cast iron or 30 pounds of aluminum.
Car. If it's a nuclear car, you know, you got all kinds of horsepower. And Lou in Altamont, Lou, you're on.
Yes, with these recall issues.
Yes.
Is there any place that you can look for such things as if a particular truck has been reported for having rust problems? Because the metal that year was garbage.
Yeah, there's no official website or location that I'm aware of. There are recalls for rust-related problems, and that would turn up on any recall search. We had a call earlier with a Ford Windstar, and Windstar's got some recalls for subframe rust through. A lot of Hyundais got recalled for the same thing. The subframes were rusting through completely in the control arms were falling apart on the road, but other than that, I don't believe there is.
How does that information get to the manufacturer? Do garages report it, or only irate owners?
Well, that's a great question.
You mean in terms of a recall?
No, in terms of my truck is rusting out, my car is rusting out type thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never been presented with a survey, but...
So maybe this is one of those things where you have to carefully collect anecdotal information on the internet and sort of make your own decision.
Yeah, because you're going to get a lot of people with a similar problem.
I've tried that and found that to be ineffective. So
It's not the most efficient way.
No.
That's for sure.
That's
deal. Yeah. Hey Lou, that's a great question. I'm sorry, there's not a better answer for you. Let's go to Russ in Albany. Russ.
Hello, this is Russ. How are you?
Russ, you're on.
Oh, thank you so much.
Sure.
I have a question on I have an 09 Sonata, about 120,000, and it's just been doing really, really well. But I'm having some transmission, kind of like upshifts and sometimes some downshifts, a little bit harder than it used to be. And I noticed that there's a drain plug on my transmission. It doesn't look like I can change the filter. Can I just drain it try to get as much as I can out of it and try to refill just to see if I can help it along.
Yeah, I'm sure there are recommended transmission fluid change intervals. Do you have an owner's manual in the car?
Yeah.
What do they tell you for mileage? Do they give you an interval?
They tell me 100,000, but every place that I've, especially the Hyundai garages, basically they want to do like a flush, and I just don't feel I like to ever get a flush. But I don't know if I could just drain it, but they do want some type of a transmission service at 100K.
Yeah, basically.
And I'm okay with that. I just don't want to do a flush type of thing.
Yeah, you can do a drain and refill, and I'm pretty sure on that vehicle there is a conventional dipstick. You can
yes.
still check that fluid level yourself, correct?
That there is, correct.
Yeah. I would, at the very least, do that myself.
Do you check that hot or cold?
There's a spot for cold check and hot check, but you should check it at
correct.
Operating temperature.
Okay.
And with the engine running in most cases. Some cars you don't like.
So you can check the transmission dipstick while it's running?
Yeah, you do that with
like
just
neutral.
Most cars.
Okay.
Hondas, you don't. The Honda Matics are checked with the engine off, just like an oil.
Mm.
I believe this Hyundai, you check it with the engine running in park. But yeah, I would definitely do a drain and refill. And I don't know how much comes out on those. You're never going to get it all out.
Correct.
That's why they recommend a total flush, so you get all the fluid out with all brand new fresh fluid in.
Yep.
All right.
And the only reason I'm saying is I have a 78 car, and my wife said, "Why don't you just do the same thing to mine? You know how it's shifting fine." It's like there's no filter on this. I can't drop the pan like I can my old guy. So, but I figure there was a drain plug. I said maybe it's not worth it. Maybe it's worth it. Give it a try.
Yeah, to do a drain and refill, if you do a whole bunch of them, you'll get more and more and more of the bad fluid out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's what I would try.
Russ, thank you very much for the call. Although I've heard you mention that 2009, not that old, but some older cars, don't touch the tranny fluid.
Yeah.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
There is, we've been through that with some callers over the years, that sometimes you may not want to go there with it because you could turn up other trouble because of the severe mileage and wear on everything.
And it's working.
Yeah.
And leave it be. All right, let's go over to Lynn in Shelburne. Hiya, Lynn. You're on. Are you? All right, you're not on. Let's go to Jesse in Stanfordville. Jesse.
Hey, guys. I have a question about my 91 Oldsmobile Tornado Trofeo.
Okay.
This vehicle, I love it. It's an interesting car, but it's not the safest thing because when it feels like it, the dashboard just doesn't operate. When you turn it over, it's just not there. It's all digital and it's gone.
Yep.
And it seems to be related to weather. If it's a nice day, then I have a fully operational dash. I have my fuel gauge, my speedometer, it's all there. If it's rainy and cold, it's not there.
Yeah, not uncommon with digital dashes, particularly of that vintage. And most of the time, the problem is in the unit. It's usually not an outside connection or anything you can do.
Moisture related?
It certainly can be. Yeah, definitely can be temperature related. And those units, now I don't know about a 91, but we still pull clusters out of vehicles and send them out and get them fixed. There's companies that do the electronics repair.
Mm-hmm.
And you get your original cluster back. And in terms of a newer car, there's no reprogramming. The mileage stays the same and all that. So you could look into seeing if yours is something that is still fixable, and you'd have to pull it and send it.
So you wouldn't think that it's just a wiring issue. It's actually in that unit itself.
More than likely, it's within the unit. I mean, it's possible it's something else, but it's almost always, the problem is almost always in the unit itself. You know, and it's a whole cluster that just comes out in one piece.
So that's a 91. Can you get a cluster like that fairly cheaply on the used market?
That's a good question, because that car's old enough to where there's probably no programming issues or rejection issues, if you want to call it that way. There might, but then you're going to get somebody else's cluster that may have other issues, and your mileage isn't going to be correct if that means anything to you. You know.
Well, yeah. Well, is it legal to tamper with the mileage?
Well, you're not tampering with it. You're just changing the component. And when the car gets sold on the title, it needs to be checked true mileage unknown.
Ah.
But this car is to the age where I don't even think that's an issue anymore. You know?
Okay. Well, very good. I guess it's like an ex-wife, right? After a certain amount of miles, it just doesn't matter. All right, Jesse, thanks a lot. Let's go to Hanny and Hadley. Hannah.
Hi. I have a 2005 Subaru Forester. It has 127,000 miles.
Yeah.
And at low speeds when I'm turning either direction, although it started just when I was turning to the right, it shakes, trembles, like it's just like a vibrating feeling. I thought it might be the transmission or the power steering or maybe a problem with the wheels, but I was wondering what you guys thought.
It's possible that you have a loose belt.
Okay.
And I believe an 05, did you say it was a Forester?
Yes.
Yeah, I believe that still has two belts in front of the engine.
Okay.
So I would, and they're, what they are is they're little flat serpentine belts or poly V belts. You should make sure, have somebody check, make sure those belts are in good shape and they're tight. Generally, if it's low fluid, you're going to get a whining, screaming sound and not give you that shuddering.
Okay.
But I would start with the condition of the belt, condition of the fluid, and then go from there.
I mean, does it have to be the power steering if you're getting a shimmying when you turn? Couldn't it be something else, tie rod ends or something else?
Well, Hannah, is it when you're basically steering at a very, very slow speed, like going into a parking space? Is that when you're feeling
it? Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Or turning off my street onto the main road. Yeah,
that's what I think, because if you're going faster, you're not going to feel it because there's way less demand on the power steering.
Mm-hmm.
And and Ray had a good question. You're not getting a shaking or a shimmying car at like 50. This is really slow speed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's where I would start with
it.
Okay, cool. And I had one of the belts replaced about a year ago. And it's also an automatic transmission. I don't know if that makes
any not really, not for this particular.
So it's probably
problem.
Not transmission related.
I doubt it.
Okay, Hannah, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Over to Jay and Hadley. Jay, you're up. Jay, are you there? Is anybody there? All right, let's go to Amy in Greenfield. Amy, you'd probably be the last one here. Maybe not.
Oh, I'm lucky then. Thank you. Okay, I'm looking to buy a new vehicle. I have an old Saturn that is going to bite the dust any second. So I'm looking for my family, a Toyota Sienna XLE, and I have one in mind. And just wanted to, you know, see what you thought. It's a 2000, has 140,000 on it. And it's going for $4,500, and it's been it's had one owner, a woman, and just wondering about that. I don't know if it's all-wheel drive or front wheel, because she just wrote all power, and I don't know what that really means.
Yeah, maybe she's referring to the accessories as far as power locks, windows, maybe it's got a sunroof and stuff like that.
Yeah, she did say that. She also said it was like 25 miles per gallon on the highway, that she's done the math, and she was amazed that, like, it's pretty good.
How many miles on this thing?
140,000.
Yeah, they're a good van. Being a 2000, it's getting a few years on it. I think it would be nice to have the car checked out.
I'm going to bring it to like a Firestone place or something, because it's in a different state. So I thought I already made an appointment actually to just bring it there, and they can just look it all over. I think that would hopefully be reliable.
Yeah, there's another way you can do that too. There's services that go out and check out used cars for you.
Are they expensive?
Oh.
I think they're $100 a visit.
So well, this is only 10 minutes away, and it's less than that.
That's a good idea. That I would get it checked out, because it's old enough to where you could have some trouble.
Amy, we are done here, and thank you so much for calling. So that's interesting. So at what point do you not want to spend $4,500 on a car that's 14 years old?
Well, you know, that's the thing. There was a time when you could get a $100 car. I'm talking probably about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And then $1,000 would buy a car. Then two. You know, now everything's $5,000 for anything decent.
So checking it out. Always prudent.
Always.
Gordon Fricke, thank you for being here on my first show since the fun drive. You made it very easy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Support comes from Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities, open 7 days a week. YeOldWarwickBookshop.com. Hudson Valley Goldsmith, specializing in custom-designed fine jewelry and repairs, created live in an open studio in downtown New Paltz, also featuring the work of more than 10 fine jewelry artists from across the U.S., HudsonValleyGoldsmith.com, and CSEA, beginning a second century of service to all New Yorkers, people working together to help make a better New York. Thanks to Gordon Fricke of Barber & Fricke Automotive. Thanks to Zach Malloy for handling the controls. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Well, see, it's Thursday. That means tomorrow's Friday. That means tomorrow is a Food Friday. I have no idea what the show is, but I'll bet you it'll be tasty. Stay tuned now for a news update.